That's going in to make guns and machinery and tanks and so on to kill Ukrainians.
Well, I mean, if I were to quote one number, which is one that at least I know, this is that last year we paid for kind of similar volumes, the US about 15 billion euros for US LNG. So that would be in this order of magnitude. Now, for this year, you would have to reduce this number by about one third.
Okay, so it's coming down, but coming down slowly.
It's coming down. It will come down next year, and it will definitely be significantly reduced by 2027.
All right. Okay, we'll leave it there. And Sophie Corbeau, thank you for coming on to Times Radio to explain that. That's it for me today. I'll be back again, 1 o'clock tomorrow. But up next on Times Radio, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the programme. 2 o'clock, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until four.
And in the next 2 hours, the national curriculum is set for its biggest shake-up in a decade. We'll talk to a head teacher about what they make of the changes. Also, what makes us Brits British? Well, Montecito man Prince Harry has got a view, and we're going to ask the man behind a most British institution, Count Binface, what he thinks about it. We'll hear more about why officers from the Met are taking industrial action today, despite Bonfire Night being one of the busiest days of the year. And our big guest after 3:30 is Paul Polman, the former chief executive of Unilever.
Here's the news at 2 o'clock on Times Radio. James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, says he's outraged and appalled as the Metropolitan Police confirms another foreign prisoner is on the run after being mistakenly freed. It follows the high-profile release of the migrant sex offender Harush Kabatu in Essex. Times Radio Will Hobbs has more.
The error at HMP Wandsworth in South London happened on the 29th of October, just 5 days after the mistaken release of Kabatu from HMP Chelmsford. It was also 2 days after Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy announced enhanced checks on prisoner releases. Police have confirmed the prisoner is a 24-year-old Algerian man. It's being reported he was serving time for trespass with an intent to steal, but has previously committed sexual offences. The Met says officers are carrying out urgent inquiries in an effort to locate him and return him to custody.
Earlier, Mr. Lammy was repeatedly challenged in the Commons by the Shadow Defence Secretary, James Cartledge.
Can he reassure the House that since Kabatu was released, no other asylum-seeking offender has been accidentally let out of prison?
Deputy Prime Minister.
Get a grip, man. I know I'm the Justice Secretary. That's why I'm at the dispatch box, also as Deputy Prime Minister.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has called the episode a shambles of government, while Reform UK has branded it a farce. Elsewhere, a driver has rammed into pedestrians and cyclists on a French holiday island. Authorities say two people are in intensive care after being injured on Île d'Oléron off the Atlantic coast. A suspect, who's 35 and from the island, is said to have shouted "God is great" in Arabic as he was arrested. The motive of the attack remains unclear, and the anti-terrorism prosecutor's office is currently not involved. New York City's next mayor has told supporters they've toppled a political dynasty after being elected as the youngest and most progressive candidate to hold the office in decades. Zoran Mandani's called himself Donald Trump's worst nightmare. The US president claimed things would have been different if he were on the ballot. Speaking to Times Radio from the White House, former special assistant to President Trump, Andrew Giuliani, said the cost of living was a major factor in the result.
Very easy to go and promise free this and promise free that and gain votes. But we know through history that opportunity is really what can get people out of, let's say, the doldrums of, you know, a paycheck to paycheck living. And that's, I think, what President Trump represents. It's not necessarily what Zohan Mamdani or socialism represents.
AI mortgages and fake news are among the subjects being added to the school curriculum in England. Primary age children will learn how to spot misinformation as part of efforts to boost their critical thinking and protect them online. Tom Middlehurst from the Education Union ASCL insists pupils won't be thrown into the deep end when it comes to complex topics.
What we're talking about is a really well-sequenced curriculum that starts with basic understandings about money and about lending and builds up over time into a much more sophisticated and comprehensive understanding than we currently have.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Quite the kerfuffle at PMQs today. It was actually Deputy Prime Minister's Questions. David Lammy was in charge. And, the controversy, you'll hear more about it later. But essentially, you need to know that a man has been let out of prison by mistake again. A 24-year-old Algerian, not an asylum seeker, but we understand that he was released in error from Wandsworth Prison last Wednesday. So a lot to talk about there. More later in the programme. The national curriculum, changes are going to be made. What is happening and why? Prince Harry has written a short essay. It's called The Bond, the Banter, the Bravery, What It Means to be British. And he is sounding very nostalgic about Blighty, the pubs, all the banter we all have here. He says he might live in the US, but Britain is the country I proudly served and fought for. Now, we've both read this essay and parts of it are actually moving and I would say spot on.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And he starts by saying remembrance has never been about glorifying war. It's about recognising its cost. And he goes on to say at the end how, as we bow our heads this weekend, let us remember not only the fallen, but the living, those who still carry the weight of war in body and mind, and the families who bear its memory in their hearts. And if you live near them, knock on their door. If you see them around, shake their hand. And if you feel so inclined, join them for a cuppa or a pint to hear their story and remind them their service still matters. So all of that, I think, is thoughtful, and I can't see why anybody would disagree with that or feel that they can take the mick or whatever. But we do need to talk about the banter of the mess, the clubhouse, the pub, and all of the things that you just think, yeah, you really are missing those, aren't you? Because none of those exist in Montecito.
No, but you can't get a decent pint of mild there. I would doubt it. Also, we've got to acknowledge the fact that carpers are saying, why is he doing it now? Could it be to take some of the shimmer away from his brother's trip to Brazil? After all, he could have waited to a little bit nearer remembrance, but the actual weekend is this weekend. Why has he done it now? However, I'm with you. I think parts of it are well said, I would say, in reference to some of the sentiments in that essay. We will talk about that very soon. Why are thousands of Met police support staff on strike today? It is bonfire night. It's the busiest night of the year for the police. The nation's top TV critic, Scott Bryan, will discuss Down Cemetery Road, the Traitors finale, and the return of the ever-gloomy Shetland, which is back on the BBC tonight at 9 o'clock. And yes, there has been a murder. Our tech expert, Chris Stokel-Walker, is going to talk about the man from The Big Short. And we should probably be worried about this. He has bet millions against the AI boom. Now, what does that mean? How concerned should we be on a scale of 1 to 10? He's got quite a few people flummoxed. Heads are being scratched. Maybe he's onto something, maybe he isn't. Chris will make sense of it a little bit later. And our big guest is a man called Paul Polman. So who's he?
So he is the former chief executive at Unilever, and he was the guy responsible for really changing the direction of the sprawling conglomerate to try and make it more accountable and sustainable and ethical. And he really did the business, and he broke the mould. So shareholder returns over the course of his tenure were up by 290%, which, if you're a naysayer and believe that you simply can't be those things, you cannot be ethical and sustainable and noted for your contributions against climate change, you will not have any profit left in your books. That completely disproves the theory. He is no longer CEO at Unilever, but he's incredibly important in the corporate world. He's at a youth summit in Munich at the moment, and he's got some rather positive things to say about how he thinks the world is going to develop in terms of capitalism. It's worth mentioning just all of the products that Unilever brings to our door. And they really do. If you walked into a supermarket and you were asked to spray paint every shelf with Unilever product on it,
yeah,
the whole supermarket would be absolutely covered in paint. There are things that don't seem to go together. They own Marmite and Bovril. They own Comfort and Persil and Surf.
That's just
and then
weird.
Ben and Jerry's and Magnum.
Well, that's right. Okay. More later. Paul Polman is the man's name. Thank you. Let's look at the most read stories on the Times website. At number three, it's a rapper blocking a road. This chap has been trying to make a video, but it's caused carnage in the Peak District. Local residents have accused Tion Wayne of treating Winnett's Pass as a playground. The gentleman used a 300 grand Rolls Royce to prevent other vehicles from passing. At number two, Socialist, yes?
Yes, no, go for it.
Socialist Zoran Mandami has won the NYC mayoral election in a historic race. Andrew Cuomo conceded defeat to his younger rival, while the Republican candidate, Curtis Sliwa, was third. Donald Trump reacted with a social media post just declaring, "And so it begins."
And the most read piece on the Times website, France car ramming, 10 hurt in suspected terror attack in Saint-Pierre. The suspect shouted "God is great" in Arabic as he was arrested on the French holiday island of Oloron. You can also read about the breaking news of, as Jane was mentioning, another prisoner being accidentally released. It comes soon after the mistaken release of sex offender Hadush Kabatu. The Shadow Defence Secretary James Cartledge repeatedly challenged the Justice Secretary David Lammy at PMQs over whether any further accidental releases had occurred. And five times David Lammy refused to answer the question before Mr Cartledge broke the news to MPs.
A police manhunt has been launched for a second asylum seeker mistakenly freed from prison. The question is, Mr Speaker, how can you advise me on how I can ask the Justice Secretary whether he was aware of this when I asked him about it repeatedly in Prime Minister's question?
So it turns out that the 24-year-old Algerian man was mistakenly released from Wandsworth Prison in London on the 29th of October. Police have launched a manhunt. And while Mr Lammy says he is outraged and appalled by the release, we will talk about that with Theo Usherwood in the next hour of the programme. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
And to contact us, the WhatsApp number is 0333 003 2353. David says, "I don't know about Montecito, but there aren't many places anywhere that you can still get a pint of mild. One is the Pear Tree in Hook Norton. Are there any others?" David, well, we'll probably be able to celebrate very soon. He's on tenterhooks, he says, waiting for the birth of the first grandchild. Well, we're thinking of you. Do let us know, David, when that happens. Definitely have a pint of mild. Possibly on us when the great event occurs. We'd love to hear from you this afternoon. That number again, 0333 003 2353. Let's talk about the school's school syllabus facing a big change. A new report says the curriculum should start to reflect today's society, incorporating lessons on AI and misinformation. And this new review recommends cutting exam time. Here's the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, defending the proposed reforms against conservative attacks on Times Radio Breakfast.
This is about strengthening, in many key regards, academic subjects like science, making sure that all young people have the chance to study triple science at GCSE, but also tackling the problem that we face around the fact that many of our young people, as they move into secondary school, aren't able to read confidently and fluently. And that really holds them back, because if you can't read well, you can't access the whole school curriculum. But I do recognise that there are many strengths within the current system, a system that is working well for some children, but not for all children. And that's especially true where it comes to children with SEND and also children from white working class backgrounds. And I do believe we need to make change happen in order to deliver a better education for those children who were not well served by the Conservatives, whatever they might say.
Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary. Well, Nick Gibb was the school's minister for almost 10 out of the 14 years of the last Tory administrations. He spoke to our colleague Hugo Rifkind earlier and criticised what he called the soft bigotry of low expectations.
We've risen in those international league tables. We're now fourth in the world in reading because of our focus on phonics. And we've risen from 27th in maths in PISA to 11th in the world as a consequence of that but also the reforms to the national curriculum that we introduced in 2012 and 2013. I mean, listening to Bridget Phillipson there, that is the classic soft bigotry of low expectations, that somehow children from poorer backgrounds should not be studying those challenging subjects like, you know, math, English, two sciences, history, geography, a foreign language that is in the English baccalaureate combination, which this review has decided to abolish.
Well, that was Nick Gibb, Tory Schools Minister. Simon Kidwell sits on the Executive Committee of the National Association of Head Teachers. And Mr. Kidwell, you also run a primary school in Cheshire, is that right?
That's right, yes.
OK, so what do you make, first of all, of what Nick Gibb was saying there? I rather like that expression, the soft bigotry of low expectations. Is that something you recognise?
It's quite a well-worn phrase, and it was adopted in the George Bush administration a long time ago. No, I don't actually, because I think the scope for the curriculum review and the ambitions of the new government, especially around the children from with SEND or children from disadvantaged backgrounds, it's plain to see that that is something this government is focused on, and the review is focused on that as well. And actually, Nick Gibb should be complimented, really, because the curriculum review is talking about an evolution of the curriculum that he helped develop, not a revolution. So a lot of the good things developed under the last government are being kept.
Right.
So I don't see it being dumbed down at all.
OK, so there's been an acknowledgement then, albeit not an explicit one from Labour, that actually the Tories got some things right.
Well, that's what I'm reading into it. I mean, I think using the curriculum as a political football, and I'm reading that the Times subheadline that talking about education vandalism is plainly wrong, because we're not seeing a significant change in the curriculum which was developed 10 years ago under the Conservative administration.
Right. Now, I appreciate that you work in primary schools. Your organisation, though, the National Association of Head Teachers, doesn't. Much like the English baccalaureate. Now, this review says it ought to be scrapped. So you're happy, are you?
Well, it's an accountability measure, isn't it? It's not actually a concept for children, but it does mean that some schools are funneling children into having a narrower choice of GCSEs. And we do welcome that, because it means that children can choose a broader base of subjects. But we heard from the curriculum review, they are also strengthening the fact that children that want to take a triple science can do so. So I think it's a welcome thing, because some schools have followed the EBAC target that the government have set, and some schools haven't. So there's been and it hasn't really improved the uptake of languages or the progress in languages. So I do think having that measure removed is a good thing.
Right. I mean, in your experience, did pupils enjoy doing the EBAC?
Well, EBAC is, I think it was around limited choice, and the young people, I've been at our school for 14 years, so I do keep in touch with the children when they go to GCSEs, and they liked having the choice of being able to choose a suite of subjects which include things like art, music and PE, without having to be constrained with some of the limited choices that the EBAC gave them. So I think young people, and the young people I've spoken to since the curriculum review was published, have said the same, that they think it's better having a broad choice.
Well, are you, as I am, interested in this notion of a diagnostic test in maths and English at year 8? Just explain the significance of year 8. This is when the pupils are, what, 12? Is that right?
Yeah,
12, 13?
So it's a key stage 3. We've got 4 key stages in schools, and we used to have key stage 3 tests, which were abolished over 10 years ago. So I think it's been introduced, and in the curriculum review it talks about a diagnostic test for reading maths. What the government's proposal is to have a test for just for reading, not for maths, because say schools can test with maths anyway. I think that is something, if they're going to be strengthening the curriculum for children who are aged between 11 and 13 for reading, that's a really good thing. However, I think when you introduce a new test, it's really important that the data that we get from these tests isn't then published in league tables, so it becomes another hard form of accountability, which can be quite divisive and can also tilt the curriculum in certain ways.
But is that a particularly crucial year, that year 8? The truth is, I would imagine, I'm not a teacher, that if you get to that level and you do still struggle with literacy, then the truth is the rest of your educational career is going to be really tough for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, typically children learn to read at six and become fluent at reading. That's where we have quite a lot of input into phonics. So actually, any children that don't pick up that, it's really important that we teach children to read very early. However, we mustn't then write children off who are still struggling. They might be struggling with fluency. It might be the pace of reading, because I don't know. I mean, I've been working in primary schools for a number of years, and I can't remember sending any children off to high school who are illiterate. Yes, some children have slow processing skills, but children can access print. They might not reach this expected government standard, which is, you know, is very challenging, because we are one of the best primary school reading countries in the world. If you look at the league tables, we are very high performing in primary reading. However, there are some children that still need support, and we mustn't think that the teaching of reading stops when they go to high school.
And what about the notion of cutting hours, several hours of exam time? It actually, over the course of the exams, probably just means 10-minute, 15-minute, minute tweaks here or there. But I suppose some people might interpret that as dumbing down. Exams are meant to be tough. They're supposed to be a test for you.
They are, but some of our 16-year-olds, and if you've had a 16-year-old go through the GCSE process, it's a tough old process. Having to, some of our children are having over 30 hours of formal examinations when they're 16, and we're a bit of an outlier globally. I think only Singapore has more formal testing at 16 in terms of hours. So I think any recommendation to reduce that, and especially with some of the mental health issues we have with children, is a good thing actually, because we want an exam system with well-designed exams that allow children to demonstrate their best, and sometimes the intensity and the length of some of these tests can be quite difficult for children.
Thank you very much, Simon. That's Simon Kidwell, who's on the Executive Committee of the National Association of Head Teachers, and he is the head of a primary school in Cheshire.
Now, Peter brings us news that he had a pint of mild last week at the Moo Dog Brewery in Taplow, and it was delicious. Mm. Are you fond of the mild?
No.
I thought maybe you had a particular predilection for it. Coming up, what defines Britishness? Prince Harry says that he knows. He says it's the banter of the mess, the clubhouse, the pub and the stands. That's what does it for him. He's landed himself in Montecito, where he is probably being inflicted with listening lounges, wellness centres, Reiki parlours and a corner shop run by Goop. So we sent him our very best today. We will talk about that next. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrund and Patrick Maguire.
This very important geopolitical decision hinged on a guy in a cupboard with nil intercession by anybody.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone, and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees. Conditions apply.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wickes, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
The bond, the banter, the bravery and the clubhouse, are those the words that spring to mind when you think about what it means to be British? For Prince Harry, who now lives the other side of the Atlantic, it's a yes. The Duke of Sussex has written an essay ahead of Remembrance Day, reflecting on his pride in military service and his affection for what he calls the things that make us British. Not everybody is agreeing with his definition, though. Comedian John Harvey, also known as Count Binface, joins us now. Very good afternoon.
Hello, it's lovely to be on the show.
Well, it's very nice to have you, Your Honour, or whatever it is about to your count.
Jane knows all too well, having had to spar with me on election night.
You didn't win. Don't overplay your part.
Oh, come on. I mean, I think I'm doing better now than Rishi's doing, irrespective of his lovely Times column. You know, it's Binface is still standing strong. I'm playing the long game.
Are you? Okay. Did you manage to sit on a bench and have a chat with Rishi as well, or is it just
no.
Count Binface?
To be fair to the Count, he made himself only two available on election night.
Is he not busy enough?
He seemed to have time for me. Right. I was very touched.
Would you stop all this jauntiness, please?
Yes, sorry.
Carry it on down the pub. Go on a date together. You'll be fine. John, let's talk about what Prince Harry has said, because actually in his letter about, it's an open letter to all of us, about Remembrance Day, he's got some really thoughtful things to say about the cost of war, the people who are left behind. He's been particularly moved by the sons and daughters who he's met through his journey, through the charities that he supports, who are always there marching proudly at the cenotaph this weekend. He says they don't march with bitterness, but with love and pride. And then he says this lovely thing at the end, which is a call to all of us to actually remember Remembrance Sunday in the right way, as an opportunity to talk to people who have an experience of service. And I think all too frequently we think we buy a poppy and we've done our bit. So these bits of his letter are really well worth amplifying, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's best to start with that, because we mustn't be too churlish, because although there is plenty to mock about Prince Harry generally, if there's one aspect where, and some of, as we'll, I think we'll probably talk about, some of his family members haven't found a dignified place for themselves, his role in sort of amplifying the cause of veterans, their families, and the cost of war is perhaps the single greatest contribution he's made in his adult life, I think. And so it's in that sense, doesn't feel like it's a cynical thing for him to do. It does feel in keeping with the sort of the role he's given himself. But there are some aspects within it which maybe are more amusing. But the, as you say, the overall tone of it, I think we can praise.
Yeah. Let's talk about the things that he loves about Britain. So he's obviously sitting there poolside of Montecito. He's thinking, how do I sum up my love for my country in the kind of, you know, the small experience that other people will understand? So he's gone for the banter of the mess, the clubhouse, the pub and the stands. And he just sounds like a guy who got married, had kids, doesn't see enough of his mates anymore. I mean, that's a bit sad, isn't it?
It is. And I'll tell you what, I think the word stands is doing a lot of heavy lifting here. It's the one which I've seen left out of certain news reports on it. But I think I know darn well what's going on here, which is that he was poolside last weekend, Saturday afternoon, more precise, I'm guessing, watching England versus Australia on the TV instead of the best seat in the house in Twickenham, which, of course, he had for many years. So I think the stands is probably the thing he's missing most, because I think he is a huge rugby fan and he missed out on seeing England giving the Aussies a good walloping. So that's definitely something. And, you know, I think you mentioned he also talks about the banter, the self-deprecating nature of Brits, which I think does give us license to sort of rib him a little bit here. And I think those things are fair. But given that you guys have, as a lot of the news have called this an essay, it is, firstly, it's only 647 words. So that is generous. It's more, you know, an amuse-bouche. And I'd never thought I'd find myself marking a Prince Harry essay. I want to ask you guys if I'm going to get paid the same as Rory Stewart when he was a royal tutor, because he was on a fair a bit of money for that. But really, if you read it, it's a testament to the quality of British universities, because, of course, Prince Harry didn't go to university, and some of his language, I think you can tell.
Right, OK, well, that's very damning indeed, isn't it? I completely take your point about the stands. I too think that that's a very important thing. And just in those four things that he lists, there is something of the... kind of deserted male, isn't there? Because all of those things that he's referring to about being part of a great big kind of pack of noise travelling through sport, travelling through entertainment, travelling through your weekends. And of course, that's the terrible problem when you become incredibly wealthy and you disappear up a very long gravel drive with a great big gate at the front of it. There isn't a pub and there isn't banter and there aren't lots of mates just around the corner.
Mm. I mean, you say disappeared. I mean, he's always been up that long gravel drive, I think, literally and figuratively. So that's one of the bits in the essay, which sort of doesn't ring quite true when he tells everyone, oh, you know, if you see a veteran, you know, give him a shake of the hand, take him for a cup or a pint, when you sort of think, well, don't you only do that in very, very sort of strictly sort of marshaled circumstances? It's all right for you to say that. Do you actually really do it? So there's a little bit of that. But I suppose also it's not quite as blokey as it might initially sound. We've all, I think, you know, Jane, you mentioned a pint of mild, mm-hmm. just before we did this segment. You know, women enjoy the going to the rugby and going for a pint as well. And we mustn't stereotype it too much. And I do think the if we are to sort of link it to sort of my experience, one of the things we're in doing comedy, I honestly think there are elements to what comedians do in Britain, which you'd find hard to do in some other countries, because we do, I think, have a remarkable ability to take the mickey out of ourselves. And I think there's a lovable amateurishness about sort of our society and us, which we all sort of, I don't think it gives us a warm feeling. I mean, I it certainly sums up my political career. And of course, as we're discovering today, it sums up the Home Office as well. So, you know, there are pros and cons to it, but I think it is resolutely British.
Yeah. So if you were cast away to an extremely well-off gated community, John, what do you think the things would be that you would list as really summing up your longing for Britain?
Well, I mean, at the moment, I've got a toddler and we've got another little baby on the way. And so my abilities to mix down the pub and in the stands and all the rest of it are going to be severely curtailed. So I do feel Prince Harry's pain, although I don't quite have the pull, as you say, in Montecito and all the rest of it to be a salve. So I do appreciate that sort of lack when we don't have those things we adore, when it is simply just going to a pub quiz. That's a very British thing, isn't it? That kind of thing. Or just going bowling or a bit of a crazy golf, those kind of things. If he's missing those, then I feel for him. But I think he has some sort of side benefits that the rest of us don't, put it like that.
Yeah. And actually, when he thinks of Britain, it is different, isn't it? Because it's kind of his country he's thinking about with a capital H. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. That's John Harvey, also known as Count Binface. What would you list as being the Britishness that you would miss?
Well, I was just going to mention, I've just been looking at the Parliament UK website just to remind myself of what happened on election night. Because in case people were confused by the early part of that interaction with the Count, John.
In case they weren't up at 20 to 3 in the morning.
Listening to Times Radio's election coverage. I mean, what's wrong with these people? But anyway, was it 20-3 or 20-4? Anyway, he stood, the Count, in Richmond and North Allerton, which is Rishi Sunak's constituency. And it's just very funny on the Parliament website because it's just all very official. Lists the constituency, the candidate, Binface, Count, and then turnout 65.7%. Votes... How many votes do you think the Count got?
Well, I mean, this is a British thing as well, isn't
it? Yeah, well, this is what I'd miss, you see.
I would say 628.
No, a rather feeble 308. Now, apparently, I think we can remind ourselves of what happened on election night. Thank you, Ryan.
I haven't got the Prime Minister, but I've got something a lot, lot better. A member of, well, are you the aristocracy? I landed gentry. I never quite know where a Count fits in.
It's Binface, of course, everybody. Good morning from North Allerton Leisure Centre at the sexy time of, what is it, 18 minutes to 2 in the morning. How are you, Binface?
Well, I'm all the better for speaking to Jane Garvey on Times Radio.
Hello. Right, that's enough. So it's 20 to 2. There you go. No idea what time it was.
Should we do the British thing after we've gone to the news because we're a little bit late? Which, again...
It's incompetence.
It's a very British thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's get the very latest news headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Another foreign prisoner's on the run after being wrongly released just 5 days after the sex offender Haroush Kabatu was freed in Essex. Scotland Yard's confirmed an Algerian man was let out of Wandsworth Jail in South London last Wednesday in error. It's understood he was serving time for trespass. The Justice Secretary says he's appalled and outraged. In the Commons earlier, David Lammy repeatedly refused to say whether the Kabatu incident had been followed by any further mistakes.
After his release, I put in place the toughest checks we've ever had in the prison system.
Meanwhile, a small boat migrant's been sent back to France for a second time in a matter of weeks. It's understood the Iranian man's case was fast-tracked after he returned following his first deportation. The brother of a man who killed three girls at a dance class in Southport last summer says the attacker feared the outside world. Dion Ruda Cabanas told an inquiry children may have been targeted because of their society value. Two people are in intensive care after a motorist drove into pedestrians and cyclists on a French holiday island. Officials on Ile d'Oléron say a man's been arrested. And education experts admit finding enough teachers for a potential new AI qualification may be a challenge as changes are announced to England's curriculum. GCSE exam times will be shortened. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Making your home more energy efficient has many benefits, both for the environment and your personal finances. Angela and JP live in Barnet. They've gradually made a few improvements to their home, and it all started with a smart meter.
It's enabled us to take advantage of the latest technology, specifically with solar panels and electric vehicle. My motivation for getting a smart meter primarily was to facilitate the utility company's smart energy tariff. We feel a lot less anxious about utility bills nowadays. I've never looked back since.
It's new technology and you should embrace it because it's there to help you. It's made so simple. Suddenly now, I'm getting a flash on my app. It says, you've got 2 hours of low cost electricity, and you can turn around and say, I'll put the dishwasher on, get that washing from your children's room, throw it in. I was just, why didn't we do this before?
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter. Eligibility may vary.
Add water to your will and know that from that single drop, life will grow. Communities will flourish. A better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it, to change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today, an exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. The experts in bathroom design and installation. Transform your bathroom. Book a free home visit and measure, and then let the Wix design experts help you choose from thousands of products. Book a free bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar is here to tell us what's on his programme at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Hello, John.
Hi, Fee. Look, so I'm going to be majoring on the American elections. You know, the sort of scenes in New York City, just enormous jubilation there. And it was a very, very good night for the Democrat Party side. So I'm looking at that. And the results were not a surprise, but the turnouts were absolutely startling. Huge turnouts in New York, biggest turnout since the 1960s. But where do they go from here? Obviously, those who voted, and all of them did, didn't think much of Donald Trump. But what do the Democrats make of it? What sort of party do they want to be, you know, when the dust settles and they take lessons from all of this? So I'm talking to Will Pavey in New York. I'm talking to Joe Walsh. He's used to be a Republican. Now he's a very, very vociferous Democrat. And looking at the numbers, how the vote shook up with James Johnson, the pollster. There's also two really big reports out today on the school's curriculum. I'm talking to the author of that report, Professor Becky Francis, and Charlie Mayfield. I've already spoken to him about workplace occupational health, which to some people may sound a little bit dry, but the numbers are startling. I mean, we're talking about a cost to the economy of over $200 billion pounds on this, and how much, you know, can be done to try in the workplace to try to do something about people being healthier and staying healthy. And some of the numbers just hit you really, really hard in the head. I mean, less than one in 20 people with learning difficulties have got a job at all, which I simply did not know. And so we're going to hear, you will hear from Charlie Mayerfield on his report and what he thinks about it, and other things too.
Lovely stuff, John. John is here from 4 o'clock this afternoon through until 7. We are going to talk about police staff going on strike in a couple of moments' time.
We certainly hope to. You will recall that the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, made that speech yesterday. Just 3 weeks before her budget, the Chancellor refused to commit to Labour's manifesto promise not to raise national insurance, income tax or VAT. Now, with Nigel Farage and Reform also backpedalling on tax cuts, is it time for the politicians to just be more honest about the state of the British economy? For today's episode of the Story podcast, Manveen Rana has been speaking to The Times policy editor, Oliver Wright.
There was a lot of talk before the last election that maybe politicians across the board just need to be a bit more honest. Everyone has a manifesto pledge that promises the world, and actually, maybe we just can't afford that. Do you think this is the moment where that's what we're sort of seeing? Politicians are having to fess up and admit that a lot of these things that they're promising just aren't economically possible.
I'm going to say something controversial. Don't we, as the public, need to fess up?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, but shouldn't there be a more honest conversation?
Aren't we getting the politicians we deserve? The basic point is that since the financial crisis, the UK has got poorer. We've got less money. During COVID, and actually during the energy crisis as a result of the war in Ukraine, political pressure on politicians meant that they spent a huge amount of money that we as a country didn't have.
Yeah.
And you've got to decide. There was a bill, I remember Rishi Sunak saying it at the time, and he was very worried about the furlough scheme. You know, there is going to be a bill at the end of this. We're going to have to pay this back. You know, I don't think politicians in any way can absolve themselves as responsibility for this, because I think that they've been part of this conspiracy not to say in terms that the UK is poorer, that you're not going to be able to afford the things that you want. It's not the way in which it was in the early 2000s when everything was great. They want to sort of still pretend that you can have jam today and jam tomorrow. But I think the public also need to realise that, because otherwise it's just a sort of recipe for everyone to be miserable.
It really is. Now, while I'm part of the public, and I understand we do need to accept that there's not necessarily going to be jam today and jam tomorrow, or jam ever at this rate, is there some hope on the horizon? I mean, is there anything that we can sort of look to as something that it's not all bleak? It might get better.
I think you can look at some of the things that this government is doing, and actually things which any government that was in power was doing. They're putting a lot of effort into identifying and supporting the sort of technologies of the future to try and make sure that the UK is at the forefront of those. And if you look at things like medicines, bioscience, AI, quantum, compared to an awful lot of countries, we are not in a bad place. Our financial services are still, relatively speaking, strong compared to other countries. And if you have a period of relatively benign world events, then you could see actually the UK being quite a bit better off in 5-10 years than it is now. I think the risk, and why everyone needs to be cautious, is it doesn't feel like we're living in a benign world, and the UK economy is still, you know, much more fragile to any kind of shock than it has been, because we spent the money during COVID, we spent the money during the energy crisis as a result of the war of Ukraine and the financial crisis. So, yeah, if you want to be glass half full, you can hope that things actually were, yeah, maybe a bit calmer and things maybe a bit better, but just have one eye on the rearview mirror.
The Times policy editor, Oliver Wright, speaking to Manveen Rana. The budget is still 3 weeks away, just stubbornly refuses to get any closer. There will be magnificent coverage here on Times Radio. I should say you can hear more on the Story podcast if you're interested in what Oliver was saying there. One story told in depth every day. It's available completely free wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We will talk about police staff striking in a couple of moments' time, but first, our favourite telly critic, Scott Bryan, joins us to talk us through this week's telly. Hello, Scott.
Afternoon.
Now, Down Cemetery Road is the latest of Mick Herron's novels to get the TV treatment from the same people who brought us Slow Horses. It's on the same platform. It stars Emma Thompson and Ruth Wilson. There are two episodes up at the moment. I wolfed them down and was genuinely devastated to realise that I couldn't watch the whole lot. I couldn't eat the whole pack of biscuits at once, Scott. Are you enjoying it?
I am. I mean, I do think it is. Sometimes I think these sort of episodic drops can be a good thing because it keeps the show in the public consciousness just that little bit longer. I mean, sometimes I find if Netflix or streamer drops 10 episodes in one go, you will watch it or people will watch it in one go. And then by the next week, everyone's on to the next thing. So sometimes I find, and Apple have been doing this from the very start, always having weekly drops. But I agree with you. I mean, I found Down Cemetery Road just such a page turner. I know it's a page turner in relation to books when I'm talking about TV, but as a fact that the plot kept moving, the performances were just so interesting. The story itself, you know, is not necessarily realistic, but you don't necessarily mind.
We don't mind at all, Scott.
No, we don't. But I think it's something about, I mean, it continues the wry sort of sense of humour that is so evident in Slow Horses and is what has made Slow Horses such a huge hit, whilst, of course, featuring none of the characters. But I think it's also, I mean, it's all about conspiracy. It's all about trying to get to the truth and the fact that the authorities, every single person saying no to you and you just don't believe them. I think anything with Ruth Wilson and Emma Thompson in is always going to pique my interest, and they're giving fabulous performances here. I would say if you are on the fence about whether you should be having an Apple TV subscription because you've not been taken by the other shows, I say now is probably a good time to do so because you've got Slow Horses is just wrapping up quite recently. That's 5 series long at least to binge, and then you can easily now sort of get involved in this over the course of the next month or so.
Yeah, it is really, really good, and I think Emma Thompson, she just gets better and better, and the role that she's playing, it's right for who she is, it's right for her sardonic sense of humour, it's right for her strength, and it's right for her looks. So I think it's just bang on the money. Let's talk about Ryan Murphy's new law show, All's Fair. Now, that's not gone down quite as well, Scott.
Yes, from Down Cemetery Road to this. I mean, it's... This is a show which is so surreal because it's been completely, you know, blasted in the reviews, you know, from the Times, all of the other papers too, one of which gave 0 stars for it. Ryan Murphy, of course, I think it's been a phenomenal TV maker, although in recent years it's felt more and more that he's been making projects which sometimes feel like he's kind of sending in homework, filing the homework, but not really paying that much attention to
it. So what else has he done?
So he did a really bizarre show called Doctor Odyssey, which was cancelled after one series, where basically you, the viewer, tried to guess which medical emergency happened on this cruise line. And they would get increasingly more abstract, and it was a bit kind of, it was a bit like a dream in a way. It's sort of like the people who were in it in this sort of fictional drama were all sort of fairly unbelievable, and you know, there would be sort of cases of the world's rarest disease would happen on this cruise line and somehow they could help sort of cure that person. But it was soapy, it was ridiculous, the performances were completely ludicrous, and it sort of had charm. I found that with All's Fair, which it's got quite a big A-list sort of cast, you know, Kim Kardashian, Glenn Close is in there. I mean, it's about a sort of set of women who decide to launch their own legal practice. But honestly, the acting, I would say it is a like GCSE drama, but I think that is an insult to the people who actually take part in GCSE drama.
So the reviews are worth reading, though, because they are just so brilliantly acerbic and damning of it. But we were talking about this in the office earlier, Scott, and actually for those of us who grew up with Knots Landing, with some pretty appalling things like LA Law. We are used to just really, really cruddy TV being made in the name of I don't know what. And is it really that different?
I mean, bring back Triangle and El Dorado is all I'll say.
El Dorado. Yeah. Good Lord.
But, I know. But I mean, I would say that don't get me wrong, there is a place for sort of sometimes, you know, bad TV, but in a way you kind of like that it's bad. You like Emily in Paris. I mean, this is just bad and there's no escaping how bad it is. And I also don't think people, I mean, I might be wrong, I don't think people are going to stick with it because they get that kind of feeling that you know, they will sort of feel quite self-indulgent, or sort of they're indulging in something a little bit sort of Moorish. I think it's just the fact that everything here is so wooden. I mean, for one thing, the music throughout it is, you know, on those keyboards, those electric keyboards, there's an instrumental button.
Yeah,
it felt as if someone pressed the instrumental button and just left it on for the full 45 minutes because the music would be continuing on, sometimes overpowering the acting, and you had no idea really what was going on at any time, but the music just carried on anyway. Right. And it's just a surprise, I think, because Ryan Murphy, you know, has done some sublime series in the past. You know, he did those American Crime Stories. He's known for, I think, sort of amplifying LGBTQ plus storytelling. He's known for making, at times, quite controversial and provocative TV. And then he's just made this. And I think that's the reason why it sort of has hit a nerve in the press today, because this is a real surprise from someone who normally gets it right, or kind of has been making quite controversial shows about serial killers and murderers, which are, you know, quite wrongly, sort of ethically quite dubious, but still addictive. This is just bad.
Has he gone through a recent divorce? Because sometimes there's definitely an alimony series, isn't there, in some people's work. Let's talk about the Celebrity Traitors finale, which is going to air this Thursday. Who's your money on?
Oh, I mean, it is so hard. I mean, I'd say that we've had 5 consecutive banishments of a faithful, which suggests that, you know, it's all going to be on the traitor side. But I would say the fact that you've got Nick Mohammed on there and also Joe Marler, the rugby player, I think really starting to work out other people's strategies, I think it could be a faithful win potentially. I mean, I have to say the ratings for this are absolutely staggering. So far, I looked at the ratings the other day, and sometimes the ratings are immediate and sometimes you have to wait a week for the catch up on iPlayer to be included too. So far, last week's episode got about 14 million, which is double what Strictly got the same week. Double. You know, and Strictly is the second most watched TV show in the UK, and The Celebrity Traitors is the first. So that's how much of a cut through this show has had, which is staggering. And it's exciting at a time when a lot of TV, you know, very rarely gets over 1 million viewers. You know, any live linear TV channel very rarely gets 1 million now. And this regularly gets 8 times that on a week.
Every agent in the land must be camping outside the offices of, who makes it?
Studio Lambert.
So yeah, the same people behind Gogglebox and other huge hits.
And Celebrity Race Across the World, which actually starts on Thursday night, the same night as Celebrity Traitors, just before 8 o'clock. And that's not bad either. That features teams of two, maybe less well-known names than on the actual Celebrity Traitors, but travelling through Central America. And I can't say exactly what happens, but one of the pairings makes, I think, one of the worst but funniest decisions they've ever made in this entire show so far. It is completely hilarious. And it's one of those times where you know that the producers tried all they could not to intervene or tell them that what they were doing was wrong.
Right. Oh, that sounds great. I love that programme too. Very brief word on Shetland, which is back.
I mean, Shetland, I just like, because it's sort of fits into the hallmarks of crime and detective work and interesting stories. But I do sort of sometimes worry about the death rate up there in Shetland, because honestly, it makes Midsummer Murders seem quite quaint.
Yeah, it's very good for knitwear, though, very much like Claudia in Celebrity Traitors. So some small wins. Scott, it's always lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. We were talking about Down Cemetery Road, which is on Apple TV. Let's just all give All's Fair a complete miss. Celebrity Traitors, it's 9 o'clock, isn't it, this Thursday, to see the final of that. And Shetland is back tonight.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Calder and Tosh.
go to an isolated hamlet and discover...
It's very unwise, Jane. it's very unwise. As we've often said, the TV show that you and I are going to make, where we're two middle-aged female detectives, is going to be called Call for Backup. And we're simply
immediately
sit in our car with our thermos and wait for backup to arrive.
It says here they uncover dark secrets and terrible deeds at the heart of a close-knit community.
Well, there's the knitting again.
Yeah, well, there we are. Absolutely, knit one, pearl one. Right, it's Times Radio. It's Jane and Fee with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. The Evening Edition, tonight from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Designed for every adventure. Search New Volkswagen California to find out more.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Add water to your will. And know that from that single drop, life will grow. Communities will flourish. A better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it. To change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
You can be part of the Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast community. Our podcast comes out Monday to Thursday at around 6 p.m. And it's good, actually, if I say so myself. Some of the banter is quite funny. Your emails are brilliant. There's a great one in today's episode about what Cavapoo gets up to with her Boris Johnson dolly. You won't want to miss that. There are also some really interesting interviews. Now, lately we've had Joanna Lumley on, the novelist Peter James, and Fee has been talking to historian David Olashoga. Now, in the week where Andrew Windsor was stripped of his titles, Fee asked David if he thinks this marks a real historical change.
I think they have. I don't think we'll understand it for a few years, the level of significance of it. I'm always cautious about sort of predicting the decline of the British monarchy because it seems to survive every historical age and every crisis that's thrown at it. But this has not been a good week and it isn't a good look. And, you know, I've always been open that I'm a Republican in the British sense, not the American sense, I should stress. And that it is a, I think, an antiquated form of institution, but it is what we have. And because it is what we have, and because our king is our head of state, I want it to succeed. So, you know, there's a certain amount of sadness watching what's happened. I think what's happened is entirely appropriate. And I think few people would argue with that. But it does seem like this is a very specific moment of crisis. And I think with the passing of the Queen, I think a lot of us suspected that crisis was on its way. She was an incredible figure of solidity and continuity. And that her absence, I think, has been felt more greatly this week than any week since her passing. It was always going to be difficult, and I think it is proving difficult for the monarchy to adjust to the passing of the longest reigning, the longest living monarch in our history.
Do you think her reputation suffers at all, David, because Prince Andrew now, Mountbatten, Windsor, it'll take all of us quite a long time to stop saying
it. I can't quite work out what it is yet.
Forgive me for that.
Mountbatten, Windsor. It's been changing over the past week. It's been evolving.
Yes, it still remains a bit of a mouthful. But anyway, Andrew was said to be her favourite son. I mean, she undoubtedly helped him out enormously in terms of where he lived and how he lived. And I know that she is said to have wanted to censure him after the Newsnight interview. But actually, don't we come to realise that everybody within that family must have really been able to see Andrew in the light that we see him in now for a very long time?
I think it is sad that it has taken the emergence of all of this evidence for the institution, you know, we call it the palace, but it is a group of people and their advisors to act. I think it would have been far better if this had been done many years ago. And this is something that the royal family is going to have to reckon with. But in some ways, to go back to my earlier point, the royal family have been through so many crises. And it is a sort of braver historian than myself who would sort of predict the end of an institution that seems to weather every storm. This is entirely, in my view, appropriate. I think it would have been far better, as I say, if it had happened earlier. But the monarchy seems to be able to survive. The question are the attitudes of younger people that seem to be quite profoundly different on than their parents and their grandparents on this institution, is that longer term risk in some ways more significant than this short term, you know, quite appalling crisis?
Sure. And presumably all of this plays into what you are telling us in History's Missing Chapters, that actually our obsession with some people at the top in terms of royal households and people who find themselves in leadership positions obscures the really interesting and valuable lives of so many other people.
I think so. I know there is a big shift which has been taking place over many decades away from history just being the stories of great men, this Victorian Thomas Carlyle idea that really history was a series of biographies of great men. Now, that is not to say that significant figures don't have this colossal impact. I think the impact of Donald Trump will be something people will be talking about for centuries. But I think we are drawn as a people increasingly to a form of history that is more expansive, more inclusive, more about us and the lives that people like us lived through rather than what happens in palaces and parliaments. Mm.
The historian David Olashoga, a very welcome guest recently on Off Air with Jane and Fee, which comes your way Monday to Thursday at 6 o'clock. Get on board with that and become part of the Off Air community.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
That all takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk about the scramble to find another mistakenly released asylum seeker. And we'll also talk about PMQs. Could the AI stock bubble be about to burst? One of the heroes of the film, The Big Short, thinks so. That and more in our tech news slot. And our big interview is with one of the most important figures in the world of business, Paul Polman, the former chief executive of Unilever. Let's get the very latest news first with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, says he's outraged and appalled as the Metropolitan Police confirms another foreign prisoner is on the run after being mistakenly freed. It follows the high-profile release of the migrant sex offender Harush Kabatu in Essex. Times Radio's Will Hobbs has the latest.
The error at HMP Wandsworth in South London happened on the 29th of October, just 5 days after the mistaken release of Kabatu from HMP Chelmsford. It was also 2 days after Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy announced enhanced checks on prisoner releases. Police have confirmed the prisoner is a 24-year-old Algerian man. It's being reported he was serving time for trespass with intent to steal, but has previously committed sexual offences. The Met says officers are carrying out urgent inquiries in an effort to locate him and return him to custody.
Earlier, Mr. Lammy was repeatedly challenged in the Commons by the Shadow Defence Secretary, James Cartledge.
Can he reassure the House that since Kabatu was released, no other asylum-seeking offender has been accidentally let out of prison?
Deputy Prime Minister.
Get a grip, man! I know I'm the Justice Secretary, that's why I'm at the dispatch box, also as Deputy Prime Minister.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has called the episode a shambles of government, while Reform UK has branded it a farce. Meanwhile, a migrant who returned to the UK by small boat after being removed under the government's one-in-one-out policy with France has been deported again. The Iranian national came back across the channel on the 18th of October after being forced to leave a month earlier. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, says she will do whatever it takes to secure our borders. The father of the Southport attacker says he didn't report some of his teenager's violent behaviour because he was worried he'd be taken away. Alfonso Rudacabana says he was frightened of his son, who killed three young girls at a dance class last year. Reporter Katie Barnfield says an inquiry's also heard about the attacker's school life.
He said his son's behaviour deteriorated very quickly, particularly in 2019 when he was expelled from the range school for bringing knives into school. And it was then 2 months later he returned to that school to attack another pupil with a hockey stick.
And New York City's next mayor has told supporters they've toppled a political dynasty after being elected as the youngest and most progressive candidate to hold the office in decades. Zoran Mamdani's called himself Donald Trump's worst nightmare. The US president has claimed things would have been different if he were on the ballot. In Britain, the Green Party leader, Zach Polanski, says there are lessons for fellow progressives.
I think the left more generally around the world are going absolute solidarity with minority communities, with trans people, with migrants. But actually the problems that are facing them more than anything is inequality. And inequality faces all of us, other than multimillionaires and billionaires.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So we are going to talk about the changing face of corporate culture after 3:30 with the former chief executive of Unilever, Paul Polman. He is still a very important figure in the corporate world, but he really did break the mould when he, in his first couple of years of tenure at Unilever, just decided to try and take that huge sprawling conglomerate in a different direction and prove that you could be profitable as well as ethical. So there's plenty to talk about after 3:30 there. And we're also going to talk about whether or not the AI bubble is going to burst. There is nobody who is clearer on this than our fantastic tech journalist, Chris Stokel-Walker. He has been in the tech world since its infancy, so we'll talk about that with him too. Our political news this afternoon, though, focuses on something that happened at PMQs. Another foreign prisoner has been mistakenly released from prison. It was the topic that dominated Prime Minister's questions, with David Lammy standing in for Keir Starmer. The Justice Secretary was pressed five times on whether he could confirm that Hadish Kabatu was the only asylum-seeking offender to have been wrongly released from prison, but failed to give a direct answer. We will talk about the immigration status of this man that they're seeking at the moment in a couple of minutes' time. Let's hear some clips from PMQs, though. He was up against the Shadow Defence Secretary, James Cartledge.
He's the Justice Secretary. He's responsible for the justice system. He needs to take responsibility, and I'm asking him a straight question. And I'm going to repeat it once more for the avoidance of doubt, because he didn't answer it twice. He's here to answer questions. Can he reassure the House that since Kabatu was released, no other asylum-seeking offender has been accidentally let out of prison? It's a clear question. Can he give an answer?
Deputy Prime Minister.
Get a grip, man. I know I'm the Justice Secretary. That's why I'm at the dispatch box, also as Deputy Prime Minister. We know that. I'm not going to pray an aid. Dame Anne Owens is a former Deputy Commissioner in London, head of the NCA. It is for her to get to the bottom of that work. Of course, we know that there have been spikes since 2021 under his watch. When did he come to this house and apologise?
Well, that's the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, on full throttle there at PMQs. Let's talk to our political correspondent, Theo Usherwood. Theo, can you just tell us what exactly is known about this prisoner so far?
So what we know, Fee, good afternoon, is that the prisoner was released from HMP Wandsworth in London on Wednesday the 29th of October And the Metropolitan Police was informed about that release in error at just after 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon. Now, the prisoner is a 24-year-old Algerian man, and the Metropolitan Police are saying they're carrying out urgent inquiries to find him and return him into custody. But he is not, we understand, an asylum seeker. He's just, from what we understand at the moment, he's just a 24-year-old Algerian man, and he was a prisoner serving time for trespass with an intent to steal, and he had previously committed sexual offences. So that's what we understand at the moment.
Okay, so his immigration status is a detail, but it is a very important detail. We'll come to that perhaps in a couple of moments' time. I mean, it's been quite an extraordinary PMQs, because it was initially a tad baffling that Cartledge continued to ask the same question five times. Once the news broke that another foreign prisoner is on the run, he returned to the dispatch box. Let's hear this.
A police manhunt has been launched for a second asylum seeker, mistakenly freed from prison. The question is, Mr. Speaker, how can you advise me on how I can ask the Justice Secretary whether he was aware of this when I asked him about it repeatedly in Prime Minister's question?
So what had happened there? Do you think that David Lammy was actually completely unaware of this case?
No. From the statement released by the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, he describes the individual as a foreign criminal. Now, that's not, of course, the same status that Adesh Kabatu, who, of course, was released in error from HMP Chelmsford last month, and a widespread manhunt was launched. Because, of course, he was seeking asylum. He had he was a resident in the Bell Hotel. And then as a result of what happened, we saw protests outside hotels housing migrants up and down the country, and outrage in the town of Epping. So he didn't, this individual who hasn't been named as yet, is not, as I said, the same, is not an asylum seeker. He doesn't have the same status as Adesh Kabatu. But from the statement, and he goes on to say this is David Lammy, the Metropolitan Police is leading an urgent manhunt, and my officials have been working through the night to take him back to prison. So that would give the strong suggestion that David Lammy did know about the incident, presuming, of course, that his officials, and you would think that his officials would have informed him the fact that they'd been working through the night to locate this Algerian man and bring him back into custody. And that's why James Cartledge pressed the issue, because, of course, David Lammy was unable to answer the question and provide the reassurances that James Cartledge was asking for, that no asylum seeker had been released from prison in error since the release of in error of Adesh Kabatu.
Right. So is this really just boiling down to parliamentary performance? I mean, could the Conservatives accuse the Justice Secretary of actually misleading Parliament?
No, they can't, because he didn't mislead Parliament. David Lammy did not provide those reassurances. So had David Lammy said, yes, I can provide reassurance that this hasn't happened again, and then subsequently it turned out that, A, this 24-year-old Algerian man was indeed seeking asylum and had the same status as Adesh Kabatu, and that he knew about it and still told the House that he could provide assurances that this hadn't happened again, then he would have mislead the House. But he didn't. Instead, he attacked the Conservative record when it came to the prison system, and making the point that, as he saw it, David Lammy saw it, he inherited, or the government, Labour government inherited, a prison system that was in crisis and on the brink when it came to power in July of last year.
OK. So I think the fact that most people want to take away from all of this afternoon is that a 24-year-old man is still on the loose. He was in a prison in this country for some pretty serious reasons, and the police are doing their utmost to try and find him. Let's move on to talk about other stuff in the world of politics this afternoon. Not much focus at PMQs on the unusually timed pre-budget speech from Rachel Reeves yesterday. Has a bit of a goal been missed there, do you think, Theo?
Well, I think what James Cartledge was trying to do, and this is something that Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the opposition, hasn't done previously, was to pivot to an issue at hand, recognising, of course, that David Lammy is the Justice Secretary, as well as being the Deputy Prime Minister. Of course, the reason he's Deputy Prime Minister is the reason he's standing in for Keir Starmer, who's currently in Brazil at the COP summit and the Earthshot Prize announcement, along with His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales. So what James Cartledge was trying to do was to pivot to something that was within David Lammy's responsibility, but also to find a topic that was fresh and new, and that he would have answers for, but he would be have responsibility for, and to pin him down on a particular area of public of government policy, which actually was within his brief, rather than asking him to comment on subjects outside of his policy area, which he could just palm off. That's why James Cartledge went in on this particular issue. And of course, it turns out that he hasn't quite landed the punches that he would have wanted to, given what we know now and given what we didn't know at the start of PMQs, but yes, has subsequently come to light.
Sure. Daisy Cooper, deputy leader of the Lib Dems, did ask a question, though, related to the economy, one about who could be impacted by the tax rises in the upcoming budget. Here's David Lammy's answer.
Well, she knows we've got 80 years of convention, and it is for the Chancellor of the Exchequer to present her budget later on this month. But can I just say gently to her, it is under her government, in which they were in coalition with the Conservatives, that we saw austerity right across our country. And she will know that there are major parties proposing austerity again. And I know that the Chancellor will do everything she can to continue, as she set out yesterday, to invest in our NHS and our public services.
So how reassuring an answer do you think that that was, Theo, to people who are thinking, oh my goodness, here it comes again?
Not very.
No.
Sorry. Sorry.
I'm with you on that one.
If you're thinking about November the 26th and you're thinking about, you know, you're going to come home to dinner with your husband or your wife and your kids are sitting there around the kitchen table, you're thinking, we're really struggling to make ends meet and we can't afford any more pressures on our family finances, or can we afford that holiday, or what about the school fees, or, you know, we just need a bit of let up, whatever it might be, whichever sort of wherever you are. I think if you're listening to that answer, then it's tough, because David Lammy was very clear, underscoring the narrative yesterday, which of course Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, was trying to get across to the British public, that ultimately tax rises are going to have to be a necessity, and preparing the ground for breaking that manifesto pledge not to increase national insurance VAT or income tax
sure.
on working people. The point he was making is, we're not going to do austerity. We're not going to cut back on public spending. We're going to have to find the money. And of course, we know that Labour, they can't cut public spending, particularly on the areas of welfare, because of the revolt that they faced in the summer over cuts to disability benefits from their own backbench MPs. And so the only other option left, if Rachel Reeves is going to stick to her fiscal rules, is to increase taxes.
We're still 3 weeks out from the budget, so seldom will a ground have been better prepared by the time we get to the 26th, Theo. David Lammy has attracted criticism for not turning up to the House of Commons with a poppy, although he ended up getting hold of one. You know, it's not a story that will have been immediately noticeable to people who listen to PMQs on the radio, but it's always an important thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is an important thing. And of course, this was David Lammy's first moment at the dispatch box as standing in for the Prime Minister. And he actually mentioned it was the first time a black person had actually stood at the dispatch box in the role of the Prime Minister, standing in for the Prime Minister. So it was an important moment, he said, in this nation's history. There was a bit of eagle-eyed watchers of PMQs noticed that when he arrived at PMQs, he didn't have a poppy pinned to his lapel, and then halfway through he got one. It's a little bit unclear about exactly who he borrowed the poppy from, but it does appear that he's borrowed a poppy from one of his Labour colleagues and stuck it on in order to ensure that when the camera came back to him, he had a poppy in place.
Thank you very much indeed. Good to talk to you again. That Great is our you. Political correspondent, Theo Usherwood.
The poppy. I've got a bangle. I buy something every year for remembrance, but I'm afraid to say I don't always remember to wear it when I go out. So I mean, obviously the Deputy Prime Minister should be wearing a poppy in the Commons, but there is, I mean, I don't know what you think about this. On television, every single person who appears on television at the moment is wearing a poppy.
And the statement is made if you don't.
Absolutely.
And for many people, I have one of those little enamel ones,
yeah.
And it's on my outer coat at the moment.
Right.
Because that's, you know, when I got it, I put it on the coat that I was wearing. So I would appear to not be wearing
but you have
one
got
now,
one.
But
yeah.
I have got one.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult, I'm with you, it's a difficult assumption that you make about somebody
yes,
if they're not wearing
critical.
A poppy.
Yeah, because also, let's not kid ourselves, on television, you are given a poppy by the production team. If you're a guest on a show at the moment, you are given one. They've got a huge box. I mean, I would hope that every single person appearing as a guest will then make a contribution. They certainly should.
Yeah. And the statement would have been made by David Lammy if he had gone for the whole session without wearing a poppy. But obviously somebody went, oops, no, that's not great. And he went, oops, no, I should be wearing that. He might have one on his outdoor coat too.
I'm sure he has.
Do you call it an outdoor coat?
I would call it an outdoor coat if it's worn outdoors and it's a coat.
Okay. I've just realised that probably the adjective is unnecessary. It's my coat.
Yes. Well, no, because you feel the cold a little bit. You're only a little lady, so sometimes you wear the coat inside.
When I'm at work, I wear a house coat, but that is because I'm a woman.
If you're worried about etiquette, actually, we do have an interesting guest tomorrow. Lady Glenn Connor is
brilliant
with us.
Guest, yeah.
Lady Glenn Connor has written so many books over the last couple of years. She is a fascinating lady, actually. She was Princess Margaret's Lady-in-Waiting, and she's written another book. I think it's called Manners and Mischief, or Mischief and Manners, and it's a series of reminiscences about her life and time. She's always worth hearing. She's with us tomorrow afternoon. Now, Ron is certainly exercised by our next item, and I suspect he's not alone. Could the tech bubble be about to pop? That and more with our technology guru, Chris Stoker-Walker, next here on Times Radio. It's Jane and Fee with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your overheads, and a smart meter can help. Jenny Jarvis is the owner of Vibes Pilates and Yoga Studio in Cardiff. The smart meter at her studio is helping her feel more in control of her energy costs.
Having a smart meter just gives me that control, that extra control over my business costs, where I'm spending money on my energy usage, and just allows me to have a better handle on some of my overheads. I found the installation process really, really easy. The energy supplier contacted me, offered me the smart meter, and I said yes, and it was really easy to arrange a day which didn't disrupt the business. Really, really quick and easy installation, no mess was left, and didn't disrupt the business at all. I recommend smart meters whenever it kind of comes up in conversation or other business owners might be discussing keeping a handle on their overheads. So it's a really, really simple, easy way to do that.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we've been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Everything's computer.
21 minutes past three. Welcome again to our tech journalist, Chris Stoker-Walker, who joins us every Wednesday at around this time. Good afternoon to you, Chris. How are you?
I'm not too bad, Jane. How are you?
Not too bad at all, actually. Ron has a question. Well, it's a comment, really. He's waiting, he says, with bated breath. I've heard several very cogent arguments lately about why the current AI situation is very, very far from a bubble. But I also fear this circular investment track. Is it possible to disassociate these two different phenomena and see what is really occurring? OK, now this is in the light of the news that the hedge fund manager played in the film The Big Short by Christian Bale has bet over $1 billion against leading AI-related stocks. Explain everything, please, Chris, and ease my frazzled nerves.
I will try, and I will also try and answer Ron's question there for you, Jane. So Michael Burry, who, as you have said, is probably best known as being represented by Christian Bale, has decided that he wants to basically try and replicate The Big Short again in the AI revolution. So he has taken positions that would benefit him in the event of a stock market collapse of the value of two big companies that are associated with the AI movement, one of which we know and we've talked about ad infinitum, which is NVIDIA, the first $5 trillion company, the GPU chip makers that powers the AI revolution. And the other is Palantir, which is someone who actually, a company that we've heard about an awful lot on Times Radio. I think we often have Louis Mosley, who is the boss in the UK of Palantir, on Times Radio. Basically, what has happened here is that Burry believes that these things are overpriced and overhyped. So he has put on NVIDIA around about $187 million worth of an investment against their share price, and about $912 million against Palantir, saying that these will decrease. Now, that is an interesting stance to take, because actually, if we look at sort of the year to date, NVIDIA is up around about 50%. If I look at Palantir, that is up 140% since the start of the year. But he seems to believe that the bubble is about to burst here. And I guess in terms of Ron's question, it is very difficult to understand. NVIDIA has been alleged by some people who believe the bubble is about to burst, that they are doing these circular investments, so lending money to companies to buy their own chips back mm-hmm. from them, which yep. seems a little bit odd. But yeah, it's an interesting time.
Yes, I mean, from my limited understanding, NVIDIA make something. As you said, they make a product that at the moment everybody wants. So why would they be in danger? I simply don't get that.
I think the worry is that it's the hype doesn't necessarily match the reality with AI. So NVIDIA is in a very envious position at the minute. They are basically the only really big scale manufacturers of these AI chips, these GPUs. What they do is they make them, but they actually, it ends up going all around the world. So they have to get rare earth from China, that then has to go to finishing factories that have their products made in Europe by a company called ASML. Those are then put together by NVIDIA and then shipped out to lots of customers. NVIDIA at the minute has a massive waiting list for these GPUs, for these AI chips. But I think the concern that people have is that a lot of companies are adding themselves to that list and signing up to buy these chips, which don't come cheap, on the premise that AI is going to take over the world and become this huge thing, whereas actually there is a question about whether or not we will see as significant a shift here. One really brief, interesting anecdote for you, Jane. We are, if we're thinking about a bubble and a bubble bursting, we are 2 days away from a date 25 years ago when Pets.com, which was an early online retailer, ended up filing for liquidation and bankruptcy. Now, that was the trigger, basically, for the dot-com boom in the year 2000. So if history repeats itself, then we might be looking at this anytime soon.
Right. So what Michael Burry has done, is it going to inspire others to do the same, or is he regarded as something of a maverick?
So he is a maverick. He is someone who takes sort of counter-intuitive positions on these sorts of things. But whenever he does this, because he was successful, of course, in the past, other people do pay attention. So it managed to drop a little bit when his stakes in these companies was first known and his negative viewpoint on them. So NVIDIA dropped around about 4% yesterday. Palantir dropped about 8%. It's continued Palantir to drop its price after trading and kind of into the early hours of this morning. And so, you know, whenever someone who has the sort of nous of this sort of scale and size says something like this, you do have to pay attention.
Right. OK, well, we watch with interest. Fee and I might be looking at that double room in the sheltered housing for retired broadcasters when it rolls round. And obviously, I mean, in all seriousness, people are, they are pretty terrified about this, Chris, because...
I think we're on bunk beds, well, top to toe, love.
Share a bed, exactly.
If I can give you one bit of kind of reassurance, yes. I will say that, you know, the bubble is going to burst probably a little bit, but it will be a retrenchment not as significant as that early 2000s one, because actually, you know, the technology is still useful in other ways.
Thank you, Chris. And Ron, I hope that's helped you. Let us know. 0333 003 2353. I'm going to call that cautiously optimistic and move on. An AI firm has won a high court ruling against Getty Images. Now, this is over a copyright claim. Tell us about this, Chris.
Yes, so Stability AI, backed by an awful lot of people, including James Cameron, the director and filmmaker behind Avatar, had been sued by Getty, which is a large press image rights company, basically saying that they had used their images to train their AI-generating models without permission. There were a whole bunch of other arguments within that. There was kind of a three-pronged argument that Getty and copyright owners were making around what Stability was alleged to have done. Turned out that the judge said that actually this wasn't necessarily worth what they had said. So actually, they had not been using this copyrighted data without permission. It kind of helps that the copyright law that we have at the minute seems to be in favour a little bit of AI companies. It's not quite drawn up for the new era in which we live, and that means that actually it's incredibly difficult to prove this is the case. And so basically, because Getty had been unable to convince the judge that this was an issue, although they did say that Stability AI had seemingly used some of Getty's images in order to train its model, they had infringed the trademarks on Getty, but not necessarily the copyright.
OK, and a final word on something that is of extreme importance, really. Online pornography showing choking is now going to be made illegal. Now, I suppose the question really is how will it be made illegal? How will it be policed?
Yeah, this is the question that I also don't necessarily have the answer to and would love for the government to try and explain it, because it will be incredibly difficult. I suppose one way that it could be done is through pattern recognition, image recognition, and seeing these sorts of things, these actions being replicated. We know strangulation in pornography is a massive issue. There is a absolutely horrifying fact, Jane, which is that strangulation is now the second most common cause of stroke in women under 40. There was a recent bit of research done by Bangor in the last couple of years, Bangor University, which suggested that this kind of introduction of strangulation into sexual relations, because we see it in pornography, is really causing very significant damage, not just in terms of in the moment to individuals who are strangled, but then also the long-term consequences as well. Obviously, a big part of the crackdown on porn is to try and make sure that people do not replicate these things. The government has had its age verification tools that have come in. We talked last week about the 77% drop, I think, in UK access to porn websites as a result of this, although whether or not that is actually 77% fewer people going there, or whether or not it's actually just a proportion of them using VPNs or other workarounds to get there. But yeah, it is an important issue that I think does need to be tackled. I'm just not sure how that happens technically yet.
No, I think if you don't know, I don't think anybody will know. But let's hope it does happen, because that statistic about the stroke, I mean, that was, God, that's horrendous. Chris, thank you very much indeed. Chris Stokel-Walker, our tech expert, with us every single Wednesday at around this time.
Surely a simple thing would be for the providers of access to that pornography to put up display screens that say exactly that. This is a fact from the medical profession about the number of women who are suffering from strokes.
Yeah, like warnings on the packets of fags.
Yes.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, they could, couldn't they?
Don't see why not.
Be worth a try. Coming up, Paul Polman is one of the most influential figures in the world of business. We're going to hear from the former Unilever boss in just a moment. It's just gone 3:30 here on Times Radio, and probably where you're listening to. So let's get a check on the latest news headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Pete. Good afternoon. It's been revealed a foreign prisoner wrongly released from a South London jail last week was only reported to police yesterday. His release at HMP Wandsworth came 2 days after the Justice Secretary announced enhanced checks. A manhunt's now underway. David Lammy was repeatedly quizzed at PMQs earlier on migrant releases, but it's understood he thought it would be irresponsible to discuss the case. It's not thought the 24-year-old Algerian man is an asylum seeker. The former prison governor and now Reform UK advisor Vanessa Frake-Harris says jails are under pressure.
They are very tough, very violent places now. They are very stretched staff, very inexperienced staff, very poorly trained staff, very poorly supported staff.
The brother of the Southport killers told an inquiry the attacker had a profound fear of the outside world. Their father, Alphonse Rudacabana, admitted his son had random violent outbursts. A major shake-up of the curriculum will see primary-age children in England being taught about personal finance and budgeting. Meanwhile, lessons on AI and data science for GCSE students will be introduced. And New York City's next mayors told supporters they've toppled a political dynasty. Zoran Mamdani's the youngest and most progressive candidate to hold the office in decades. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mum was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were 2 for 1 at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees. Conditions apply.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in bathroom design and installation. Transform your bathroom. Book a free home visit and measure, and then let the Wix design experts help you choose from thousands of products. Book a free bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's 26 minutes to four. When Paul Polman launched the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan in 2010, his aim as CEO was to double sales at the sprawling conglomerate and halve the environmental impact of its products. During his tenure, he delivered total shareholder returns of 290%. He retired at the end of 2018, partly over his desire to take the company's HQ to the Netherlands. He is Dutch, but also the voice of the naysayers was there amongst shareholders over that, and they also didn't always see eye to eye with his campaigning vision. So what is his legacy to the corporate world? Well, he put politics with a small p right at the heart of corporate with a capital C structure. It doesn't always work, for example, with Ben & Jerry's, which was bought by Unilever expecting to be able to retain its political shape. Most recently, it wanted to launch an ice cream flavour to support a ceasefire in Gaza. One of the founders, Jerry, recently left in protest at Unilever's suppression of the activism there. This isn't during Paul Polman's time, but we do talk about it in the interview. And Mr. Polman remains a massive figure in the corporate world. He's the co-founder of the consultancy Imagine, has worked alongside the UN for many years, and is currently in Munich at the Young World Summit, where the brightest minds in the younger generations meet to thrash out the rubbish that we, the older generations, have left for them. Mr. Polman puts it better.
The summit has been going on since 2010. What we are basically doing here, bringing a group of young people together, call them social entrepreneurs, call them innovators within companies, and really work if anything, on their leadership skills, joint action, sharing best practices, and hopefully create the leaders that are more driven by purpose than profit, if you want to, with incredible ideas to change the world. So we have done this, as I said, since 2010. So we have about 20,000 of them now in the world, actually working on impact with incredible activities, nearly reaching 1 billion people with their projects. So a tremendous change that we're galvanizing as a result of this. And it's 4 days of energy that is beyond belief when you come here. Although we're there to mentor and to help and counsel, at the end of the day, I leave with more energy than I came.
Do you know what, Paul? We so need to hear about that energy at the moment, don't we? Because I think for many of us, we look out across the horizon of news and we are holding our head in our hands about the geopolitical situation and maybe also about the belief that the next generation will be able to solve the problems that have been created and left by older generations. So do you believe that basic premise that we'll actually all be all right?
Well, I don't know if we'll all be all right. Already today, we have clear warning signs that we are playing with modern nature in ways that is probably not sustainable. Now, of course, we're moving and making this a greener economy and making this a more sustainable economy. It's not that we're falling backwards. You might believe that if you read some of the newspapers, but in reality, we're moving forward. We've just waited so long to attack many of these issues of deforestation, climate change, inequality, that we have to work a little bit faster.
I'm interested in that statement, though. I mean, is it true that we are moving forwards if the strongmen who are in charge seem to want to completely disregard climate change and its impact, even though it might be affecting their citizens, and they want to pursue fossil fuels, they want to pursue wars, they want to pursue things that don't seem to fit the agenda you're talking about at all?
Yeah, we are dealing with obviously a phenomena at the political level, at the geopolitical level, that we haven't seen in our generation, at least. And to be honest, if you take one of the major countries, the United States, where we clearly have someone in office that denies that climate change is there, that undermines the science on which we like to take our decisions, etc. At the end of the day, even in that country, the economics are going to drive it more than anything else. And the economics of green energy, for example, are now increasingly more beneficial than the economics of fossil fuel. And it's not surprising, you know, digging something deeper and deeper out of the ground with a limited resource and only burning it once costs you far more money than putting a solar panel in place that you can use for generations nearly. Mm-hmm. So even in the US, you see a lot of actions at the state level, at the local level, that we should not underestimate.
I know, Paul, that you quipped when you were asked in a restaurant whether or not you had any allergies, that you did, and it was to Donald Trump. And I wonder where Keir Starmer lies in your mind. Is he a food intolerance? Is he something welcome on your plate? How's he doing in your eyes?
Well, he has a tough challenge, not only the moment he came to office and some of the things he might have inherited. I leave it to the UK citizens to decide when it's time to go to the polls. But within a global context, which I look at, I think the UK has set an example on their agenda. I think they're smart to do that. The opposition seems to be moving away from some of these promises under the false belief that that is better for the economy, that people will not pay higher prices as a result. This false dichotomy that is out there between sustainability and cost of living. But the reality is, even in the UK, people already pay today more for their energy or for their food and for their health care, exactly because we're not addressing these problems.
So you would dispute the basic premise, and it is used by opposition parties in this country, that net zero is just incompatible with growth. And at a time when we desperately need growth, we simply cannot afford to be making these decisions based on something quite far off in the future and expensive to deliver.
46 countries in the world are in line or ahead of the Paris Agreement. They are decoupling faster than is even required to stay at 1.5 degrees. And these countries are all over the world and doing reasonably well. And so they show that it can be done. The leading companies that tackle climate change at the core of their strategies and tend to be a little bit more progressive than other companies collectively are outperforming the market. The green indexes that we see are doing better than the average stock performance of the market. Increasingly, the financial market is actually betting on that direction. You take a very simple thing, the food and land use strategy in the UK. The UK is the lowest biodiversity of any OECD country. And yet it is a limited amount of money that needs to be invested every year to reverse that and have the right and consistent policies. That will save you tons of money on your healthcare when you're struggling to not provide a decent NHS services anymore.
Can we also talk about AI? And I know that it's on the agenda at the One Young World Summit as well. Where you're talking about ensuring AI democratizes opportunity instead of entrenching inequality. So many people are so fearful of what is coming around the corner with AI, and particularly for the younger generation who might find that their working environment is so radically changed by it. They might actually not have a working environment. What do you think?
Yeah, the topics here are circular economy, anti-hate, sustainable growth, but also responsible tech. And the discussions of AI are enormous. Some are pointing out that we might have an AI bubble or not. A lot of fear of job destruction. The reality is yet to be found. One thing is clear, that as far as a conversion to a greener, more inclusive economy is going, AI can play enormous roles. The benefits that I continue to see myself in education or in healthcare, just to name a few, are enormous. So how do we create a human AI? And how do we put guardrails around it? Even though I have low expectations of global agreements around this, there seems to be more progress on regional basis.
Isn't one of the lessons that has been learned from the internet that actually if you leave the direction of travel entirely in the hands of a very few people, they will compete with each other to get things to the market without those necessary guardrails? And you know, the difficulties that we have had with the internet no longer being a safe space on so many levels, if we were to learn the lessons and how to avoid that, we'd really be doing something about regulating AI at the moment, wouldn't we?
No, that is the same as if we don't put guardrails around CO2 emissions, if we don't put guardrails around biodiversity destruction. What you are talking about is what I call the tragedies of the common. You, in this case, it's very clear that there are potentially very negative effects and that we have some indicators already in some of these areas. And certainly putting the power in a few people's hands in California would seem to amass more and more money and benefit from this more than society at large at this moment is not a smart thing. But the reality is we are living in an environment where not all the politicians in this world sing from the same hymn sheet or have the same values, and where AI has become a political weapon. And we need to be sure that there's pressure enough on our elected officials to ensure that there is a responsibility.
Can we also talk about women, Paul? I feel very much that Unilever targeted me very successfully all my adult life, actually, and I have been the budget keeper of a household with kids in it. I've used so many products that came under your auspices at Unilever, as will so many of our listeners who are predominantly on the podcast, absolutely fabulous middle-aged women. So that's all good, and I think that many of us appreciated your commitment to sustainability. But the simple truth is that we then don't tend to be shareholders of big companies who are targeting us as customers, and we aren't on your boards. And I wonder whether you would see that as a bit of a conundrum as well.
Well, I want to be clear, talking for Unilever in this case, that when I came to Unilever, we did not have that diversity on the board. We had a white British man and white Dutchman, and they could disagree. So we thought we had diversity on the board, but we changed the board immediately. We had 50% women, as it happened to be, people from Africa, from the Far East, from the US. We had a truly global board with amazing individuals on that. And that helped us implement the strategy a little bit more courageously than we otherwise. We also made very clear that business, the world cannot function if you don't fight for dignity and respect for everybody, or equity or compassion, whatever word you want to put around that. So we did not do our DE&I efforts just pro forma or just in our head offices or a few parts of our organization that we could display in a sustainability report. I said, if we really want to do this, we have to drive these values into our total value chain. So when we were creating jobs for 3.5 million smallholder farmers, which is absolutely needed in places like Africa, I wanted to be sure that half of them were women. But we were building tea plantations and gave the growers of the tea a stake in the factory there. We wanted to be sure that half of them were women. When we worked on entrepreneur programs and set up small businesses, I worked with social entrepreneurs. I had an award at that time that was chaired by the Prince of Wales, now your king. We wanted to be sure that at least half of them were women.
But so this has level, all of that stayed since you left? Has all of that stayed in place?
It goes up and down a little bit, but I think the company continues to be in a significantly better position than any other time in its history.
But not everybody is doing that, and it still remains a problem, doesn't it? And that imbalance between what you are as a woman who spends money in the economy and what you are as an investor in that economy, one is up there and one is right down there. And we are not represented enough on boards, even though there is proof that if you have women on boards, your company will do better. So, you know, there'll be people listening to this who go, oh, God, not banging that old drum again, you know, whatever, 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 you're all doing fine. But actually, we're not. It still remains a really, really important thing, doesn't it?
Oh, 100% agree. And I've continued to champion that even after my time at Unilever. And one of the things, for example, here at One Young World is you see actually that there are more women than men, and most, if not all of them, will be very successful, including in managing the financial affairs or making their money work where it has the biggest impact. Over and over, it's proven that if you invest there, if you have to make a choice, better invest in women, because it gives society, but also the businesses itself, a better return. I firmly believe that. But it's the same for people, LGBT. It's the same for racial diversity. It's the same for age. You know, I fight for these things because of a basic value, once more, that we need to fight for dignity and respect for everybody.
If you found yourself sat in a room with the strong men of the world at the moment, Paul, how do you think that chat would go?
Well, I went to the White House, if you want to be specific in your question, to convince him in his first term to stay in the Paris Agreement. And that didn't go well. It was one of my many failures in life. And, you know, I had the opportunity, not in this term, but to talk to him. I would really point out very simply that the 32 technologies that are absolutely vital for the future of humanity, and think about battery, photovoltaic, electric vehicles, etc., 28 of those, China has a big competitive advantage. I would make him a little mad by saying most of the technology they probably stole from the US. But if you want to make America great again, which nobody is against, I want Britain to be great again. I want the Netherlands to be great. So I don't get emotional by these slogans. But then, you know, invest in the future, don't invest in the past, and don't let China run away from it. And as time goes by, there is an increasing evidence that the strategy of denying the economics or denying the planetary boundaries or denying the science or denying the will of the people, by the way, including in the US, is not a good strategy for long-term success. So this scenario is being written and it has not fully played out.
Yeah. Final question, and I don't know whether you are willing to comment on this, but Ben and Jerry's, which was part of the Unilever family, I think after your time, has had some difficulties within the Unilever family. And we can hear your politics displayed in the answers that you're able to give us today. And I wonder whether you think that politics and personal displays of politics just will never be appropriate within a large corporate setting. Is there a cowardice involved in those decisions, or is it just a fact?
So what do we call politics nowadays? I think a company needs to be concerned about biodiversity destruction. A company needs to be concerned about climate change. A company needs to be concerned about the growing inequality in this world. We also have children. We also have grandchildren. Increasingly, we see the politicians operating under a timeline and election cycles that don't match where the private sector is. So you might call things politics or not politics. Frankly, climate change should not have been politics. It should have been driven by science, like it was for many times in the UK. Until now, some political parties come in, reform the Conservatives, surprisingly, and start to make it a political item and drive this as a point of differentiation. Outright wrong, because we're denying science here.
Well, I think it's an absolutely beautiful political speech, and I'm taking from that that you don't want to comment on Ben and Jerry's.
No, I can comment on Ben and Jerry's. I'll do that in 2 seconds. Ben and Jerry's is an activist brand. They have about 1,000 different campaigns a year. Also, when I was at Unilever, I love the brand because they pushed the boundaries on many things. They fought for LGBT in Ireland and got that approved. They prevented destruction of the coral reefs. They want less money in defense and more in education in the US. It's an activist brand, and ice cream has nearly become an excuse. And Ben and Jerry themselves as individuals are great activists. They are worried that under the new structure of independent company that Unilever has decided to do after I left, that that freedom to be an activist, which was firmly ingrained in the agreements when they were acquired by Unilever before I arrived, that is being put at risk. And they want to safeguard that. Can it be safeguarded within that new ice cream company that is being set up, or does it require Ben and Jerry's to operate independently like a B Corp, whatever? I leave that to many people that are more qualified than me. But it is not surprising that there are some issues that are controversial. In this case, the Palestinian issue, where many people felt that there was genocide going on, where finally stories are coming out and images that were beyond belief that touched the hearts of many people. And Ben and Jerry's is an ideal brand to say we fight for that, and we want to be sure that what we do in our business model gives people the right to their land, that they can live with dignity and respect. And the world standing by, not acting, was something that for that brand, thankfully, in my opinion, personal opinion, I'm not talking for Unilever here, was courageous enough to speak out about. How that is being done and what is happening at a personal level there behind the individuals and the company, I'm not privileged of. So, but I always have appreciated Ben and Jerry's pushing you into the area of discomfort, because it's only in that area that more discontinuous change happens. And if we are afraid to embrace that, we're afraid to live fully.
Paul Polman, the former chief executive of Unilever. And we were talking there about Ben and Jerry and what has happened recently within the company. And you can watch Times Radio Breakfast interview with the Ben and Jerry co-founder, Ben Cohen, on the Times Radio YouTube channel if you missed it this morning on Breakfast.
Yeah, interesting. What's this from Simon? He says, I'm delighted to report that in Germany, Unilever products are often on the shelves. The locals have no idea it's Anglo-Dutch.
Mm. And Mike says, I don't buy Unilever products. There are many cheaper options. What's interesting, Mike, actually, is in their rack of products that they have bought over the years, you'll quite often find cheap, medium and expensive within exactly the same product range. So they have cornered every single part of that market.
Fabric conditioners.
Yes.
That's an intriguing area, isn't it?
It is to many of us, Jane.
Well, no, because I'm completely...
Mike, is it to you?
I'm very much attracted by the different fragrances advertised.
Yes.
The packaging can be rather alluring. But you're right, they're all made by the same
people. They are. I didn't realise this. So Surf, Persil and Comfort are all made by Unilever.
Just remarkable. But my mind was well and truly blown by the Marmite and Bovril thing, which I genuinely didn't know. By way of contrast, our guest at around the same time tomorrow is Lady Glenconner. She was Princess Margaret's lady-in-waiting, very loyal lady-in-waiting. She saw a lot. She went to all sorts of places. She had an incredibly challenging marriage to an exceptionally difficult man called Colin Tennant. She's known real tragedy. But she has, in the last couple of years, really come to the fore in her own right. And she's
hugely enjoying her success. She is 93, I should say. She's written a number of books, and her most recent one is just a series of reminiscences, really. She talks a lot in the book, Fee, about primogeniture, because she would have inherited her family estate, except that she couldn't.
She was a woman.
Because she was a woman, and she had two sisters. And she then had an incredibly tricky relationship with her father. But it's also going to be interesting to see whether she has anything to say about Andrew Windsor. And because Andrew Windsor was the Princess Margaret of that generation, the one who was second in line but was never going to get the big job. And it presents some challenges, as we've discovered. Anyway, so Lady Glenconner with us tomorrow on the programme.
So lots to look forward to. Thank you very much indeed for all of your messages this afternoon. We'll squeeze a last couple in after we've heard from these creative commercial people.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
This year, Amazon are increasing the electric delivery vehicles we use across Europe to 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of, where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts, and where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So Andy wanted to know, what is the Marmite and Bovril thing that Jane and Fee just mentioned? Well, they're made by the same company. And we think that they're very much, they're like anti-magnets, those two, aren't they?
Well, one's yeast extract.
And the other is beef extract.
Work that one out. I mean, they look similar.
And they taste similar.
Well,
they do.
Yeah, they do.
They do. Yeah. And
hang on. They're not from the same big vat.
No, they're not. No, don't say that. Why does fabric conditioner not say what it is on the tin or the bottle? I was sent to buy some. I couldn't find any. I was then told that Lenore was a fabric conditioner, but nowhere does it say fabric conditioner on it. Well, Tim, welcome to our world.
I was going to say, Tim's speaking
of lady domestic products.
I was going to say, sent out by somebody to buy fabric conditioner, and the poor baffled bloke is walking up and down the aisle thinking, where does it say? Where is it?
I think it is a deliberate mystery, Tim, which is just sent to confound you, like many, many things confound us in the male world.
Yeah, I'm in sympathy with Tim. I've only very recently learned where to put the fabric conditioner in my washing machine. Turns out that for years I was putting it in the wrong thing.
This is the kind of content that you've come to Times Radio for,
oh,
and we're
sure
very, very grateful that you have. Don't worry, John Pienaar is on his way. We're back tomorrow from 2. Have a lovely evening when you get to it. Hannah was our producer this afternoon, and Ryan was our technical operator.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Now, here are the headlines. The Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, says he's outraged and appalled as the Metropolitan Police confirm another foreign prisoner is on the run after being mistakenly freed. And a major shake-up of the curriculum will see primary-aged children in England being taught about personal finance and budgeting. Coming up, we're going to be looking at what the New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani tells us about the city, President Trump, American politics, politics. And here, the government is set to give our school subjects the biggest shake-up in a decade. I'm going to be talking to the Education Minister, Georgia Gould, and I've been talking to Professor Becky Francis, who led the report on the changes. And the former John Lewis boss, Charlie Mayfield, is going to be with us sharing his thoughts on getting people back to work.
This is Times Radio.
And other news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. A 24-year-old Algerian man mistakenly released from prison in London has been named as Brahim Kadour Sharif. It comes after the Deputy Prime Minister was repeatedly pressed in the Commons on whether any foreign offenders had been freed in Arras since Harish Kabatu last month. David Lammy refused to answer the question, although it's believed he was informed overnight about the accidental release. It's understood Kadour Sharif was serving time for trespass with the intent to steal, but it's being reported he'd also previously committed a sex offence. Times Radio's Alex Dibble says the timeline of his release is particularly interesting.
In a statement that the Metropolitan Police gave to Sky News, it said, shortly after 1 p.m. on Tuesday the 4th of November, the Met was informed by the prison service that a prisoner had been released in error from HMP Wandsworth on Wednesday the 29th of October. So the Metropolitan Police saying there that they were informed 6 days after this man was mistakenly released. Why there was that delay, it is not clear.
New York City's next mayor has told supporters they've toppled a political dynasty after being elected as the youngest and most progressive candidate to hold the office in decades. Zoran Mamdani's called himself Donald Trump's worst nightmare. The US president claimed things would have been different if he were on the ballot. Speaking to Times Radio from the White House, the former special assistant to President Trump, Andrew Giuliani, said the cost of living was a major factor in the result.
Very easy to go and promise free this and promise free that and gain votes. But we know through history that opportunity is really what can get people out of, let's say, the doldrums of, you know, a paycheck to paycheck living. And that's I think what President Trump represents. It's not necessarily what Zohan Mamdani or socialism represents.
A major review suggests the UK is losing 7% of GDP and businesses are losing £85 billion a year to workplace sickness. The former John Lewis boss, Sir Charlie Mayfield, warns the country sliding into an avoidable crisis. The Times columnist Fraser Nelson says it's the first time the effect of sickness has been quantified.
Now, the Mayfield Review's figure is devastating. £1 million in potential lifetime lost earnings, with the same figure, he says, roughly again for the state. Up to £1 million per person written off. So to me, this makes a huge case for overhauling what we're doing right now and looking at the vast amount of damage we're doing socially and economically to the workforce.
The brother of the Southport killers told an inquiry the attacker had a profound fear of the outside world. Their father, Alfonso Rudacabana, admitted his son would have random violent outbursts. And AI, mortgages and fake news are among the subjects being added to the school curriculum in England. Primary age children will learn how to spot misinformation as part of efforts to boost their critical thinking and protect them online. Tom Middlehurst from the education union ASCL insists pupils won't be thrown into the deep end when it comes to complex topics.
What we're talking about is a really well-sequenced curriculum that starts with basic understandings about money and about lending and builds up over time into a much more sophisticated and comprehensive understanding than we currently have.
And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. And so it begins. That was President Trump's reaction on social media. And it summed it up. Something just happened in American politics and something really rather big. Democrat candidates sweeping to victory in Democrat New York City and the states of Virginia and New Jersey. That was no surprise, but the scale of those wins was startling. And the turnout of voters astonishing. In New York, the biggest turnout since the 1960s. And now New York, the world capital of capitalism, Donald Trump's beloved hometown, has a mayor who calls himself a democratic socialist. In American politics, the S word is used by conservatives as an insult. The two women taking over the governor's job in Virginia and New Jersey are more centrist, and that's the point. The passion, you can call it love, of MAGA Americans that has helped Donald Trump into office and which demands the total loyalty of his party, it's now glimpsed a fired-up opposition, a coalition of centrists, left-wingers, young Americans and ethnic minority voters equally determined to take Trump and his Republican allies down, and presumably reinforced by former Trump supporters who have switched sides. Now, whether the Democrats of every shade, who are celebrating wildly as we speak, whether they can settle on a message and a messenger whose voice carries away from the party's strongholds and can convince the still unconvinced, that is the huge question hanging over Trump's America today. Let's talk about that. And a bit later, here at home, two big sets of ideas have been shared today addressing huge issues facing literally millions of us. Illness and disability is keeping a staggering 1 in 5 of us out of work and costing £212 billion a year. I've been talking to the author of a major report that offers solutions in the workplace. And I've been talking to a professor who was asked by the government to help redesign the national curriculum in English schools. The ideas include learning about mortgages and fake news and AI. Sound like a good idea to you? What are you thinking? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, Zora Mamdani has now become New York City's first Muslim mayor, the youngest person in more than a century to lead the biggest city in America. The Democratic candidate beat opponents Andrew Cuomo and Curtis Sylwa. He secured more than 50% of the vote. Now, the campaign saw President Trump openly endorse Andrew Cuomo, a longtime Democrat, over his own Republican candidates in an attempt to stop Mamdani's victory. In his victory speech, Zora Mamdani addressed the president directly.
If anyone can show a nation betrayed by Donald Trump how to defeat him, it is the city that gave rise to him. So Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have 4 words for you. Turn the volume up.
But he also addressed his defeated opponent, Andrew Cuomo.
I wish Andrew Cuomo only the best in private life. But let tonight be the final time I utter his name as we turn the page on a politics that abandons the many and answers only to the few.
Now, in his concession speech, Andrew Cuomo congratulated the newly elected mayor to boos from his own supporters.
Congratulations to Zoran Mandami. That is not right. That is not right. And that is not us. That is not us. This campaign was the right fight to wage. And I am proud of what we did and what we did together.
Well, let's then talk now to Will Pavia, the new